Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and we're going to take a look at home improvement today on the program and zero in a little bit on masonry problems. You know, they're common in our climate, and we'll talk about how to repair them correctly with our guest, John Freiberger, a registered home inspector, specializes in evaluating older structures, and he'll talk about the do's and don'ts of masonry repair and take your general home improvement questions as well. So what do you want to know about repairing masonry, or are you doing a remodel? What questions do you have? Join in. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. John Freiberger, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Great to be back, Larry.
What are some of the most common masonry problems you see as a home inspector?
As a home inspector, what we're seeing the biggest problems with, Larry, is the newest masonry. The oldest masonry is the best. The newest is the worst. We have this thing that the architects derisively call lick and stick, better known as thin veneer exterior masonry. And basically, this is sometimes it's real stone that's actually sawn an inch to inch and a half thick. But a lot of times it's basically sort of like a plaster or cementous mix of fake stone. We're finding about a 90% failure rate with it. And we're finding that the sheathing in the walls behind are rotting, people having to abandon parts of their house due to the bad mold. And we're finding about 90% of it is installed wrong. So,
oh my goodness.
One of the things that we want to get out here is if you've got lick and stick or thin veneer masonry on your house, be forewarned. If you're building a new house and you're putting it on, be forewarned. Yeah. And we do have a good resource for it. The Masonry Thin Veneer Masonry Manufacturers Association, actually the MVMA, Masonry Veneer Manufacturers Association, has a nice website, and they have the fifth edition of about a 50-page booklet with all kinds of wonderful drawings showing how this stuff is supposed to be put on. Now, some companies like Owens Corning will have their own installation instructions, but this publication is so good that most of the companies like Dutch just say, use the MVMA manual.
Well, why the heck don't people use it then?
Well,
they don't know about it. It's easier to do it another way.
Larry, we just worked on a McMansion where the gentleman, who is a nice gentleman, had been laying brick for 20 years. He had no idea that there's anything in the Wisconsin Uniform Dwelling Code that talked about brick. He didn't know anything about flashing. He didn't know anything about the Brick Institute. Basically, he knew how to lay brick, but he didn't know how to put in weeps, put in flashing. So all of his brick walls leaked into the houses.
Ugh.
So one of the things that we're trying to do is trying to, and we offer this, you know, free, not just to public radio listeners, but to any mason who calls us, we are happy to give them anything we possibly can to educate them so that this stuff goes on right.
And 90% of the times now it's going on wrong.
It is going on wrong. I had a case 2 months ago where I warned the masons the day before they put it on that they needed to have the manual. They put it on anyway, and they then paid the lady $17,000 because they had to be torn off and redone. And this is being forewarned. So it really is a problem. As we always say on the program, Larry, if you're having somebody do something, go to the manufacturer, download the installation instructions, print two copies, hand one to the contractor because he's probably never seen it before.
And keep one yourself.
And keep one yourself and go out and look. The nice thing about a lot of these manuals, Larry, is they are beautifully drawn. 8 by 10 inch pages showing the detailed drawings, breakaway drawings, exploded drawings, shows you how to do basically everything. And that's why this is in the fifth edition, is when a question comes up, the MVMA improves the manual and gets it out there.
Wow. And they can, and anybody can get a free copy.
Anybody can get a free copy, yes. If you're doing limestone, you go to the Indiana Limestone Association, and you get, I think it's a 120-page book on installing. And all of the stuff is out there for free because the manufacturers don't want to see the stuff done wrong. But the manufacturers only are warranting the material. The material is put on wrong.
It's not their problem.
There's no warranty. And this is the problem that we're seeing. So One of the things that we want to do as far as the Wisconsin idea of outreach to the state is to get the information from the manufacturers out to contractors and to homeowners so that we don't have to keep giving people bad news.
Yeah. So how do we get a copy of that then? Just go to...
Just go online. If you simply Google MVMA manual, it will pop right up. Or Veneer Manufacturers Association, it will pop up.
And how do you pick somebody? I mean, when you're picking somebody to do your work, you ask them if they know about this.
Exactly. Larry, if you're selling me a job, I'd say, Larry, do you follow the MVMA manual here to the letter?
No.
And if you went, huh?
If their eyes go.
You know, there's a lot of professionals out there that have a lot of skills, including this gentleman that we helped out, you know, some months ago. The problem is they have skills, but they don't have knowledge. And you can't just have the manual skill to lay brick in a neat and pretty way. You need to know how walls operate. You need to know some basic building science. The problem with masonry is all masonry leaks. The average house, the thick brick veneer, traditional brick veneer, will leak in less than 30 seconds if we basically point a spray hose at it. We know that. We've known that for a long time. But if it is properly, if the wall in back of it has a weather-resistant barrier, if it has weeps, if it has flashing, so what? It's a rain screen. It's not a rain barrier. It's like the screen on your storm door. It stops a lot of the rain, but some of it gets through. So we need to be able to drain it out.
Our guest today, John Freiberger of Freiberger & Associates, will take some calls now. We have every line filled. The number is 800-642-1234. Let's go to Frank in Madison first. Frank, hi.
Hello, Larry. I've been listening to you for years. You never fail me, man.
Thanks, Frank.
Hey, I've got a question for Mr. Freiberger. Maybe he can give me a reference. Maybe I need a civil engineer. We live in a house on top of one of the drumlins here in Madison, and it's a very steep hill. I mean, it's 4 feet from the sidewalk is 4 feet above the pavement, and our retaining wall runs up about 12 feet and is pretty thick with a wide stairway that goes between it and a second wall in between. The point is, we want to make sure that wall is not going to fail on us and, in effect, lead to the house having its foundation crack.
So the retaining wall.
Yes, it's a big, massive concrete retaining wall, which 20 years ago we covered with we re-stuccoed it, we thought. But the stucco was more plastic or fiberglass sort of thing. It looked okay it still looks okay in the shorter sections, but behind one section it's peeling off, and we can see that the wall behind it is sort of spalling, you know, flaking off bits. So I've called around to our previous contractors, and they don't exactly have an idea who to get in on this. They didn't really have part of the job that we hired out 20 years ago. So can Mr. Freiberger give us some lead as to who to consult, who would know about how to take care of a 100-year-old retaining wall?
And, Frank, this is a 100-year-old concrete wall.
Yeah.
Wow. That's very good life for a concrete wall. The old concrete did not have a lot of Portland cement in it, and some of the Portland cement it had was not the quality we have today. Some of it had lime in it. And the aggregate in it is probably mined aggregate, so it's glacial till. So it was sand and little round stones, and sometimes even goose egg size round stones. And that is a wall that can deteriorate due to the tannic acids in our soils, because the moisture moves through the wall, sometimes in vapor form. But it can take the binders, the cement, right out of the wall. So this is something where you need somebody who really knows something about old concrete. The best choice is usually a professional engineer who actually knows concrete. That the second best choice is if you can find a home inspector who is good on concrete and has done a lot of old work. Now, what you're looking for is movement. This may slowly deteriorate for another 50 years, and if it slowly deteriorates, who cares? But if things start rotating and start cracking and you start seeing offsets, then there are some real issues. Now, are you seeing anything like that yet, Frank?
We are seeing it between the inner and the outer walls where the steps are. That was apparent 20 years ago, and we recast some of the steps on the upper level, and you can still see a little bit there as the hillside slumps forward.
And that's the other important thing to know is soil also moves in the long term. If you're really worried with it, I would probably check with a local PE firm. It's very hard to find guys that will do residential work. But one of them in Middleton is Structural Integrity. They are willing to do residential work, and they also have a lot of experience on old houses. I've often partnered with them on structural design. So since you're in Madison, perhaps give them a ring, have them take a look at the wall. And there may be some things that would be good to do at this point to preserve it, and by having them do an on-site inspection, perhaps we can do a little preservation work and get another 50 years out of that wall, because certainly it would be expensive to replace it.
Yeah, thank you very much for calling. Good luck, Frank. Appreciate your call. And Ruth in Howard's Grove, you're next. Hi, Ruth.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
I'm hoping I can get some information and perhaps a solution. We have a six-year-old footing in our garage that is crumbling, and it has a white, for lack of my knowledge, salt that's leaching out, and I'm wondering what we can do to repair or prevent any more damage.
Yeah, so it's a chalky substance coming up.
Yes.
Yeah. And Ruth, the concrete is actually coming apart, or are you only seeing this white substance?
No, it's actually crumbling.
It's actually crumbling. Okay, so it sounds like, because it's only 6 years old, unlike Frank's 100-year-old wall, this sounds like we had a bad mix on the concrete. And unfortunately, after 6 years, there isn't a lot one can do. That is, as far as recourse to either the supplier or the contractor. As usually in Wisconsin, I don't want to give legal advice, but there's an implied warranty when you sign a contract of 5 years from the date of signature. So, if this is only 4 years old, I'd be saying, let's call the contractor. But as it is, I think, again, I'm going to have to give you the same advice as Frank. You're either going to need a professional engineer, and again, it's hard to get ones that'll do residential, or you can check for a home inspector in your area who knows a lot about concrete. And you can go to the American Society of Home Inspector website or the Wisconsin Association of Home Inspector website and take a look for somebody around Howard's Grove. Most of them are going to have biographies and areas of specialty listed. So you may find, Jim Smith or somebody from some town near you who says, I know a lot about concrete. And you could start there. But you are going to have a professional look at this, because if this is 6 years old and is actually crumbling, then we probably have a defective product.
And it may have to be...
It may have to be replaced.
Oh.
Well, it isn't that bad, Larry. We've done this in the old days when you couldn't take down an old garage and put a new one up until Madison changed its zoning code. Is we would simply get inside the garage and lift the thing up and put a new foundation under it and set it back down again. It was fairly simple, but it'd be unfortunate if that had to be done on a structure that is only 6 years old.
Yeah, there you go, Ruth. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. John Freiberger, Wisconsin registered home inspector, specializes in evaluating older structures. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our producer, Sarah Hopeful, our engineer, here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, John Freiberger of Freiberger & Associates, as we talk home improvement with him. We have many callers online. Let's go to Chris in Adams next. Chris, hi. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. I'm the Koi Pond lady, and we are about to embark upon the foundation for that project, and we talked about it a little bit the last time you were on. But I have a horror story to tell you. I have a friend in Milwaukee that owns a red brick house that was built in the 1880s, and it's on the National Registry of Historic Places. And he had a crack along the house in between the front porch and the building, and it was not substantial. I went back to Milwaukee about 5 years later, and it was 4 inches wide. And I said, you have to take care of this, because if we get 14 inches of snow on that roof, it could take the whole front off your house. And so he hired a guy, gave him $5,000 up front, and he didn't even level off the thing and say, okay, there's something wrong here. He just did the work, and it was the swerviest, worst job I've ever seen in my life. And I said, this can't happen. And so he hired the historic people to come in and take the project. And they figured out that the footings were bad, and they had to tear his whole front porch up and take every brick off of that building, because they couldn't use new brick. They had to use those brick and clean them up and do it, and Bob has a $60,000 porch. But it's done right.
Oh, boy. Not an unusual type of story, though, is it?
It is not. Now, Chris, what's your koi pond question?
Oh, no. My koi pond question is, we're about to put the foundation in, and we talked about doing concrete block, and you said something about rebar, and we're going to space this away from the original garage far enough. I want to know if I should seal that concrete block against the garage wall, and I want to insulate that space down in the ground. How do I do that? How do I make this energy efficient and stable? And so we can talk about rebar and talk about insulating the space in between that. It doesn't matter. I've got lots of land. I've got lots of space. It doesn't matter how far away it is from the garage walls.
I remember when we talked a couple months ago, and you have a very complicated project. And I really think that what we need here is a design professional to help you out a little bit.
Yeah.
Because we've got insulation questions. We've got structural questions. We have long-term exposure to water. You're probably going to have pumps, electrical, et cetera. So I think we really need to find an engineer or an architect in the Adams area that can give you some help. Now, I'm sure we've talked about this before. I'm sure you've got a bunch of drawings started already, but I think you need to find somebody up there that can review those drawings for you, make sure everything is done right, because we're just too complicated to analyze over the radio here.
Without looking at things,
right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. So, there's times when a design professional, they cost money. Not using a design professional, that costs more money.
Yeah, so there you go. Chris, look somebody up and see what would she look for?
A design professional, if you're looking for an architect in your area, you can go to the Wisconsin Association of Architects and go online. They're going to give you a list of everybody in your area. And if you're up in Adams, it's probably going to be easier to find an architect than it is to find an engineer willing to do residential work.
All right. There you go, Chris. Thanks a lot for calling. Good luck. Appreciate the call. Victoria in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call. I'm another person with a 100-year-old house, and it has a poured concrete foundation. I've had it inspected, and they said it's in great shape. The problem is it's like many older houses where it's exposed about 3 feet above the ground. It had suffered a lot of water damage over the years. We repitched the soil away from the foundation, put in new gutters. But what I'm wondering now is what to put over the outside of the foundation as well as inside in the basement to kind of stabilize that, of course, after we get all that spalling stuff off of there.
Well, that's a tough question with no real good answer, unfortunately, Victoria. What is happening, we have to think of concrete as a very heavy form of sponge. And you are never going to waterproof this below grade. So you are always going to, this wall is always going to be exposed to soil moisture. And at times that soil is going to be saturated, even though you've sloped the soil, even though you're keeping the gutters clean, that moisture is going to get into the wall and it has to get out. And if we seal the inside of that wall and if we seal the exterior of that wall, what will end up happening is we'll end up with the concrete actually sort of exfoliating in fairly large chunks. So what you cover it with doesn't make a lot of difference, except that whatever you cover it with has to breathe. It can't be a water barrier. So you can take a look at various paints. You're probably going to have to do a little bit of online searching, or you may have you're in Milwaukee, so you're going to have a couple of good quality paint stores where you can talk to them about it. But you need a breathable paint, and you will continue to get deterioration. Now, there are silicate-based paints that can be used on concrete. Kilm, I believe, is one brand name, and there are several others. So maybe Google silicate concrete paints. But again, you want to find one that will breathe for you. take a look at ThoroSeal, ThoroSeal. See if that is breathable or not. Sometimes it depends upon the thickness, but you're going to need to do some research. What we don't want to do, what I see some people do, is parging these walls with things like Portland cement. And what that means is that instead of coming off in little chunks, the wall comes off in big chunks.
No.
So we got to let that moisture out. It has to be able to breathe.
There we go, Victoria. Thank you so much for calling. And Aaron in Grafton, your turn. Hi, Aaron.
Hi. I have a concrete block house that was built in the 50s, and we did add another floor to it, not concrete, but wood, about 5 years ago. But before that happened, there's, you know, over the age, there's cracking in the, there's a few cracks, and it needs to probably maybe be tuck pointed. And I'm just wondering, the other thing I've read about, like, you need to make sure weep holes are open and functioning, and I don't know how to tell that. I don't even know where the weep holes are. So I just was concerned, and now it needs painting and things like that. I'm just concerned about getting somebody to maybe who I would get to look at it if it's a concern to see how, you know, the health of the whole house, I guess, the whole concrete block.
Yes, we did sort of things in the traditional way in the 1950s with concrete block, and then we had a lot of failures, which is why the Uniform Dwelling Code nowadays has all kinds of information about how to lay concrete block, how to lay it well. But again, as we were talking with Frank about his wall, unless it's actually moving, unless you see some offsets and things like that, it's probably okay. So I think you could probably start, again, with a knowledgeable home inspector, somebody that knows about concrete masonry units is what we usually call them, CMUs, and have them come and take a look at it. Then if you've got a couple of alternatives, one is to sort of keep the block, and maybe that block was, you know, like a Taliesin-y sort of house or something where it's really intended to be part of the aesthetics of the house. But maybe it isn't. Maybe it's just a concrete block house. And it would look better if we put an exterior insulation finish system over it. That is an inch of foam and then an acrylic stucco. So those are the sorts of things, kind of decisions you have to make. Are you going to maintain what's there, or are you going to perhaps cover it with something else that would go with the aesthetic of the home? But I think start with a home inspector, because it is, as we keep saying, so hard to get a PE, professional engineer, to look at residents. And certainly in the Grafton area, I know there's a couple of people in Milwaukee that know a great deal about old houses. So again, Wisconsin Association of Home Inspectors and American Society of Home Inspectors, you can go to those websites, find an inspector, find one that is knowledgeable, interview them first, of course, and then have them come out. And if they look at it and say, Aaron, we need a PE, you know, they're pretty careful about protecting your interest.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you so much for calling, Aaron. Appreciate your call. And on to Robert in Amherst Junction next. Hi, Robert.
Hi.
What can we do for you today?
Yeah, thanks. Great program. I've got an old barn, and the north wall, which is not the bearing wall, it's the end wall, is, you know, the bottom log got totally rotten. And the first floor support log was totally rotten. So I took out that whole wall. I supported all the floor beams crossed. And now I need, you know, I want to pour a concrete foundation across that 30-foot span. What was there was just rubble, you know, just some fieldstone put in a ditch.
Right.
And then a log on top of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was rubble in a ditch. That's called a Welsh footing.
That in my house, too.
Yeah, they work great. What's nice about them is they drain water, and if there's frost protection, if there's frost movement, there's air spaces in. So this was a very traditional way of building houses for about 1,500 years. And in fact, Frank Lloyd Wright used this on many of his houses, like a Jacobs II solar semicircle, where he's got some massive limestone, sandstone walls, and he simply used Welsh footings. But if we're pouring concrete, we can't do that. So the general rule of thumb is for frost protection, we have to go down 4 feet. This is an unheated barn, correct?
So that's absolute. I mean, if I pour concrete, I got to go down 4 feet.
That's right. Unless this was a heated building, then it'd be different. But
okay.
For an unheated building, you really need to go down four feet because otherwise you could end up with frost issues. And you just can't pour. If you're rebuilding an old stone wall or something, I would say, okay, let's go with the Welsh footing because the other three sides of the barn have got a Welsh footing. But if we're switching to concrete, I think we really need to follow best practice, which is to go down. So it's not the wall has to be 4 feet, but the bottom of your footing, your 8-inch tall footing, has to be down 4 feet.
Got it?
That solves the problem.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And on to Mark in Mequon. Hi, Mark.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got a cabin up by Land O'Lakes, Wisconsin. It's a one-story cabin. A basement was put in the 70s, and it's got one exposed wall in the basement where you can walk out to the backyard. The basement was blocked, and it failed. We had a lot of offsets and so forth. So I had the cabin lifted. We had poured concrete walls put in, the block removed, of course. It turned out there wasn't proper frost footings or there wasn't even any drain tile. So proper frost wall was put in. The poured walls were put in on three sides of it. One wall is wood that's out to the backyard. And there's 2 inches of foam on the outside. I'm wondering if I should keep that heated in the winter, which I do not right now. Someone told me that if it freezes from the inside out, you could still have problems.
It's very unlikely that the concrete is going to be damaged by frost. My concern with unheated buildings is always the development of mold, because we know that once the relative humidity hits 80%, we can get mold growth. And I've been in houses that, you know, the older couple went to Florida for the winter and turned the heat down to 55, and I walked into their basement. The entire thing was white with aspergillus. Cost them $15,000 to fix it, and they saved $200 on heat. So the big concern up there is a lot of cabins. You're on a lake, you're in a woods, you're in a damp area. If that is unheated, what happens when it hits the dew point inside? If you show up in the spring and everything is white and stinky, so my preference is to go ahead and to heat them. I suppose if you could guarantee that the humidity would be low enough, but unless the walls are completely damp-proofed and everything, that's very difficult to prove. And how do you run a dehumidifier when it's below freezing? I'm not sure that's possible. So the best advice is to try to figure out what the humidity is in the building in the winter, and it shouldn't be terribly high. And then have some level of heat, probably at least 55 or 60 degrees, so that you do not end up with fungal growth due to high relative humidity. Because we have to remember, our relative humidity increases as the temperature drops, because the cold air cannot hold all of the water vapor that warm air can. So if you're at 40% at 70 degrees, you get down to 33 degrees, you're probably at 80%. At that point, you may get mold.
Yeah. So there you go, 55, 60 degrees, and that could solve you a lot of problems. Thanks, Mark. Appreciate it. Tim and Eau Claire, your turn. Hi, Tim.
Hi. I guess I just learned that I have a Welsh foundation on a home built in the 1860s.
Doesn't that make you feel better about your house?
What was that?
Doesn't that make you feel better about your house?
Right. The only problem is it's in bottom land.
Uh-huh.
And water has slowly caused that side of the house to sink.
Sure.
Several floods have caused the bottom, 3 feet of the original part of the house to rot basically away. So I'm going to have to be doing some restructuring there and all of that. I'm going to have to be lifting that part of the house about 4 or 5 inches. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a lot of fun. In all of that being said, I have to figure out what to do with the foundation. I've had some people say I should do almost more of a peer foundation. And some people say that I've had one contractor say pour an entirely new basement under the 150-plus-year-old house. Just wondering which direction you would point in.
Well, Tim, it depends on how extensive the problem is. If we only have one side of the house that is subsiding, I suppose that maybe this house is on a slight bit of a slope or something, and we maybe had some organic soils under one of the walls, you know, perhaps it's just, let's maybe just fix what's wrong. Somebody really needs to analyze the condition of the rest of that foundation to see what kind of shape it's in. It isn't all that difficult to lift up a house and put a new foundation under it. We've got one going on in Evansville right now, which is a pretty significant house where the stone foundation was really pretty shot. And so they've lifted it up and they're about ready to set it down again. So have the house analyzed. And a PE would be good to take a look at it. If you can find an old mason who actually knows something about, you know, lime rubble mortar and lime mortar rubble foundations, have them take a look at it, or see if you can get a professional engineer to take a look at it. But I have a tendency on old houses to try to fix just what needs to be fixed. The problem is that if we insert concrete into a section of wall, that concrete performs different than the stone, and I would even think about trying to rebuild it in stone. Now, you may have to put some sort of floating slab foundation underneath to lay the stone upon, but you might be able to get a mason to relay that in stone so that the wall at least acts in a similar fashion when it is affected by moisture and by temperature. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. I've even considered doing so that foundation is there, and what I've considered doing is maybe we're going to be tearing up the floor to insulate underneath that floor because it doesn't have any insulation, and that would give us access to the crawl space. And I'm not sure about the legality of doing like something similar to the way that they do decks, where they do a 4 feet down in the concrete tube and, you know, basically shore some things up that way.
That can be done. You're going to have your loads are all going to be coming to a couple of piers, so you probably are going to need a design professional. You're going to have to come up with a framing diagram and then figure out how everything is going to be supported. You may find that what you've got there is that whole floor system is sort of working because it works in three dimensions because it's sort of floating on this ring, you know, this ring of stone. And if you put in piers, you're going to be collecting loads in certain points. So that's something that's going to have to probably be analyzed by an architect or an engineer, because otherwise what you may find is that floor may start really deforming on you.
That makes sense. The only issue is on that one wall, there isn't any support anyway right now because I could stick my finger through the wood.
Oh, I'm sure you can. But it's acting in three dimensions, so the load there is going to other places. But over time, you're going to get some deformation. You can draw your own framing diagram for this house. Go to an office supply store, get some of that quarter-inch grid paper, so you can do a quarter-inch to a foot drawing or half-inch to a foot drawing, draw the whole thing up, and then take it to an architect or engineer and say, run me some calculations on this. If I'm going to do piers here, where do I put the piers? And you may find it's not real simple, because when we're collecting loads, we need wood heavy enough to be able to collect them to take them someplace without warping.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks very much for calling. Good luck, Tim. Appreciate it. Rob in Winona, Minnesota, it's your turn. Hi.
Oh, hi. Thanks for this program. It's hitting a bullseye with me right now.
Okay.
My house comes in two parts. The back part is built on a proper below-ground foundation that is not a problem. The front four rooms, which I'm sure was built at least 100 years ago, and I suspect longer than that, is on piled-up stone, which, being where I am, is probably limestone, and it was covered with some sort of cement-like something or other. Well, that cement-like something or other is coming off in several places. I tried patching it myself, but I just don't know what I'm doing. How do I find somebody who does know what they're doing?
Winona, Minnesota.
Winona, Minnesota. Okay. Now, Rob, let me ask you a couple of questions. Now, you said this looks like limestone, so it looks like quarry rubble.
I don't know if it looks like limestone, but there was limestone quarries all over the place here at that time, and so I'm guessing it's limestone.
Well, but are the pieces of stone more or less rectangular, or do you have what's called field stone? We've got a bunch of round stuff in there.
No, they've been cut or whatever.
Okay, good. Okay, that makes life so much easier. So basically what you've got is you've got old-fashioned lime quarry rubble, and you had lime kilns all over there, and it probably was a slaked lime mortar. And that, fortunately, is a mortar that you can make yourself and is pretty easy to work with. We will very shortly, actually, we have a website up. This is something brand new. I've entered at least not the 21st century, but the latter part of the 20th. So very soon you'll be able to go to freibergerconsulting.com and open it up and click on masonry and then click on repair of old lime foundations with lime mortar, and you'll have all the specifications. I would really hope, Rob, that by this time next week my IT person will have all of those things up. So I have a mortar formula in there that is two parts lime, one part Portland cement, and I believe six parts sand to that. It's sticky. It's easy to work with. You have to remember that when you are repairing this sort of foundation that you need a like a Windex bottle, but with water in it, not Windex. And if it's dry, you need to spray the stone around it because you don't want the water to get sucked out of the mortar because you don't get a good bond. But all of that information will be in there. And either you can do it yourself or you don't wish to. You talk to the oldest mason you can find and give them a copy of the specification and say, this is the way I would like it done. And our specifications generally, I also often rely upon the Department of Interior Division of Historic Restoration. And I've written some things for them for some national historic sites that we've done over the years. So this should be a fairly well-documented, approved, and standard sort of way of doing things.
Get any old concrete guys to come and do this, or do I need some specialist?
Not old concrete guys, but if you've got an old mason in the area, that's what you want. If you can find some 70-year-old guy who's willing to come out there and work.
There you go.
Somebody preferably who laid brick before the Second World War, but there's not many of those left anymore.
There we go. Thank you so much for calling, Rob. Appreciate your call. John Freiberger, our guest today, Wisconsin registered home inspector, who specializes in evaluating older structures. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at home renovation and repair here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with John Freiberger of Freiberger & Associates. Always great to have him come by and visit with us. Questions for him, give a call at 800-642-1234. Anna in Green Bay says the brick on the front of her 1980s ranch in good shape, but she's concerned about it aging. Something that she should do to help maintain it.
Well, 1980s, one never knows what type of brick we have. That's the type of brick really makes a lot of difference. There's some really hard baked brick that is pretty impervious to damage. And in 1980s, probably going to be Portland cement mortar. The Uniform Dwelling Code came into effect in Wisconsin January 1st of 1980. If Anna's house is built correctly, then there's going to be flashing above the windows, above the doors, and there's going to be weeps at the bottoms of the walls. And analyzing brick is a little bit difficult on the radio. So, again, I think what we really want to do is let's maybe check into a home inspector who knows a lot about brick. You can look up on the Uniform Dwelling Code. Just go online, type in Wisconsin Uniform Dwelling Code, and then look at Chapter 21. It's going to tell you how brick is supposed to be laid. And there's another thing called the Wisconsin Uniform Dwelling Code Supplement that even gives you cross-sectional drawings of how your windowsills are supposed to be flashed. So there's a lot of resources out there. Another wonderful resource is the American Brick Institute. Technical Bulletin 7A, 7B, 7C, etc. give you wonderful drawings on how your brick veneer should be put on your house. So those are all things that are completely free, and all you have to do is basically type in American Brick Association, and these will pop up, or Wisconsin Uniform Dwelling Code, and then search for masonry veneer. And at least you'll be able to tell whether it was done right in 1980. If it wasn't done right, then you need to print off everything, put red circles around it or highlight in yellow, and then call a local mason and say, here's my problem. Should I be worried? or is it fine? Larry, one of the big things that we've only known for a little over 2,000 years is that brick lasts a lot longer if we hold an umbrella over it. Yeah. So if Anna's house is a 1980s house with big, wide overhangs, it's a single-story house and not much rain is hitting that brick may go just about forever. Vitruvius, in his 7 books of architecture, discussed how to lay brick in Rome in 200 BC. And believe it or not, everything he says about drainage walls, veneers, overhangs, etc., is still really true today. So a lot of times it isn't necessarily the construction of the brick wall. Sometimes they're sort of inferior. But we've got big overhangs on a house, and the brick doesn't get wet, and so it lasts forever. Other times the brick is quite well laid, but it's picking up a lot of moisture, and that brick is going to age much more quickly. So brick is just like wood. Water is the enemy.
Hmm. Yeah, very interesting. John in Appleton has something for you, John. Let's go there. Hi, John.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I've got a garage about 80 years old, 90 years old, faces an alley, older part of De Pere. City redid the alleys. There's a bit of drainage, like when we had the heavy snow, you get some water in there. And over the years, as you probably common cracks and so forth on the concrete. Concrete's in good shape otherwise. My questions are sort of two-part. One is, you probably addressed this, but patching for cracks or a couple little areas where, you know, it's pitted pretty good well. And number two, your opinion on the various types of coatings that go on there, the epoxies and all that good stuff. And I guess a associated question is, dealing with the drainage, is there anything like a sump pit or something that can be done on that? It does drain. The street is about, 80 feet away. But just to get it out into the alley so, it can flow on those rare days when there's a heavy rain or, for example, a snowfall and I happen to be away. So could you address those, please?
Yeah, if it's coming up through the cracks, it's probably sort of a hydrostatic head pressure thing. Is the soil's actually getting saturated and we've got water running underneath the floor and then it comes up through a crack because that's a path of least resistance. It's trying to find its own level. Very difficult to do much about that. You can try grading around the exterior to break it up a little bit, but with many garages, you can't go very deep because the foundation isn't very deep. As far as patching, what I tell people around here is to take a picture of it and go to the local good quality brickyard. You know, you're not going to get this answered at a big box store, but take a picture out and go to the guy at the desk and say, what would you use to patch this? And you're going to tell him it's 80-year-old concrete, and he's going to say, well, this stuff, you know, latex base with this bonder probably works pretty well. The problem with really old garages where we've got some moisture coming through, if we put a sealer of the type that you're thinking of, like an epoxy, a sheet-type sealer, that is going to be vapor impermeable, and we've got water coming through. So what that is going to do is going to tend to blister and destroy that that coating. So let's take a picture. Go to, I don't know, brickyards up in Appleton, but I'm sure there's got to be a couple of them around up there. Show it to the guys at the desk, and let's get some advice from them.
All right, makes good sense. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Got a text from Renee who wonders about ways homeowners can make original 1920s wood windows as energy efficient as possible. She says, when I purchased my house, the previous homeowner had applied caulk or silicone to seal all the windows shut because they leak lots of air. What can I do to keep the windows yet also upgrade their efficiency?
Really good question, one that I love. The first thing we have to take a look at, I'm assuming these are probably old wooden double-hung sashes where the bottom sash at least still works, maybe the upper one doesn't. Not as important nowadays to have the upper one work, but in the old days, that was the air conditioning. As you lowered the upper sash and the warm air went out the window. Well, most of our houses have air conditioning now. But you can take a look at what first we want to weather strip the windows. And that can be done either with, there are 3M makes a self-adhering vinyl weather stripping. It's guaranteed for life, but the problem is it falls off. There is the sprung brass weather stripping that you can buy at the hardware store with the little tiny nails. That's a pain to do, but you can make it work. So we want to try to reduce the amount of air that's leaking through the windows as much as possible. We also have to take a look at our putty on the outside. We may have to do some reglazing and some painting. And then we want to have a nice closable storm window. Our storm window should not be sealed at the top and the bottom. There should be some airflow between those two panes of glass. So if we have a glass window from 1 to 4 inches of airspace and then a storm window, basically what we've got then is we've got an R2 window. Okay. Now, if you bought, you know, went to the big box store and bought some cheap half-inch thermopane vinyl windows, that's an R2 window. So basically, you could replace all the windows in your house and you'd still have R2 windows. Now, online, I don't have it with me today. We did a program on windows, and maybe one can find that in the archive. But there actually are at least two associations of people who restore windows. And I think if you probably Google Window Restoration Association or Window Restoration Information, these will pop up. Because on many of our historic houses, we really try to keep as much original glass wood frame as possible. And what we find is that there really is not much of an advantage to replacing windows in houses as far as an energy concern. There are other things that are much, much more important. So do a little bit of research online, Renee, and probably be a couple of weeks, but these things, again, will be up at freibergconsulting.com. You'll be able to click on windows, and then I should have links then to these associations, and then most of these associations have cross-sectional drawings and descriptions of how to salvage your old windows, because people feel strongly about this old wood. They want this stuff saved.
There we go. Thanks so much for that text. And let's take another call at time for Bill in Fond du Lac. Hi, Bill.
Hey, how you guys doing? Great show.
Thank you.
I have a fieldstone basement under the house, a fieldstone foundation, and just wondering what are the pointers that I need to keep in mind if I'm going to replace the concrete or mortar, whatever it is, that's in between those field stones.
Bill, do you know how old your house is?
It is about 100 years old now.
Okay. If it's 100 years old, it is almost certain that your mortar is a lime-based mortar, not a cement-based mortar. So, field stone is always difficult because it's round and it's slippery. So it is a lot harder to care for than the lime quarry rubble. So if you, we will have, hopefully in the next week, we will have this limestone repair mortar up online at freibergerconsulting.com, and you can use that on fieldstone. Now, if you're working with fieldstone, I would probably use two parts lime. I would use one part Portland cement, and then I would use a bonding agent like Elmer's or Acryl 60. And basically what that is, it's a latex glue. It helps your mortar stick to the fieldstone. And if you mix this up right into a nice putty, it actually is very easy to handle for a mason or even for a homeowner. What you do not want to do is go to the hardware store and buy a bag of mortar mix, because that stuff is harder than heck. That's going to be like 3,000-5,000 PSI mortar, and your old lime mortar is like 800,000 pound. And if you start putting that between the stones, it's almost like driving wooden wedges into the wall. It'll cause a lot of deterioration. So when we're replacing old masonry, we need to replace like with like. Does that cover it for you, Bill?
Yeah. Do I need to go below ground level? I mean, so we got maybe 2 feet above ground, and then I'm guessing 4 feet below on the outside.
Yeah, I can give you a definite maybe on that. Generally, what happens on these old walls is the failures are at the corners. You have to be really careful because lime disappears when it is subjected to tannic acids and other acids in the soil. So you do not want to dig so far down that you are going to basically run out of mortar, and you're going to find basically stacked up stone. So if you dig very carefully. The most important thing is going to be your corners. The rest of the wall, if it looks pretty good, just leave it alone.
There you go. Thanks very much for calling. Kathy in Viroqua emailed to say her sidewalk and driveway have settled, is having it raised with a foam product effective?
The answer is yes. The nice thing about the foam is about 25 pounds per square inch. So that's quite a bit per square foot. I can't do that math in my head. But unlike the old mud that could sort of wash out with water, the foam hardens and stays in place. And there are various foam jacking companies out there that are actually it's like a franchise. Okay. So the people are actually trained, and usually it's a national system. So talk to them. Make sure you're talking to a good person. And then go ahead and have it done, and you should get long-lasting results out of it.
Makes good sense. John Freiberger, our guest today. John is going to be with us right up till 12:30 today. He's a Wisconsin registered home inspector, specializes in evaluating older structures, and his firm, Freiberger & Associate, consults on the restoration and adaptive reuse of older homes, and other structures, including designing thermal and air barrier systems to reduce energy consumption, and the acquisition of tax credits for historic properties. So that's a good thing, too. So he'll be with us right up until 12:30. We'll take a look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we will be back with John. So you stay with us. We'll be right back after this quick look at the news. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network, taking a look at home renovation and repair. I'm Larry Mueller. My guest today, John Freiberger, Wisconsin registered home inspector. His firm, Freiberger & Associates, consults in restoring and the adaptive reuse of old homes and other structures. So great to have John back. He comes by every couple of months to talk with us. And every one of our lines is filled, so we'll go right back to the phones. Joel in Lansing, Iowa, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi there, guys. For 25 years, I lived in a house in Iowa that was in the largest historic landmark in the United States, and my house was built in 1854, before the Civil War. It was hand-edged, post and beams, all red oak. And they did a shallow foundation. They went down about 4 feet below grade, put in about 2 feet of limestone rubble, and threw some kind of cement of the day in it. And then the rest of it was built up with local sandstone, which the red sandstone is harder than steel. This is in Amana. And I did a couple things that I think would be good to share. One, going back to the old world German traditions, I overbuilt a lot of things. I had a wall that was standing between two halves of the building with the rubble sticking out, and every time you swept the floor, you swept away the dirt under the rubble. So I put in a 3-foot square footing below that rubble foundation, and then I put up a 10-12 inch foot kick wall up about halfway up on the wall with rebar and sealed rebar drilled into the foundation. And that took me a lot of time, and I was a younger kid then.
But you're older now. Did it? And it has worked well for you?
I lived in that house 25 years. Now, the Portland cement issue is a big deal in Amana because we have a lot of soft brick that were made in local ovens. You know, they set up brickworks and they have soft brick. And now people are putting Portland cement on the front and they're just blowing the front off from all their bricks.
Yep. John, that's...
Well, that's exactly what we said talking about the Fieldstone Foundation. We cannot have... We cannot mix 800-pound and 3,500-pound mortars next to each other. It's like driving wedges into walls. So people need to realize that they have old houses, that they really need to use the old-type mortars. And that's why I've taken a lot of time writing all of these documents that will soon be available, because it is not rocket science to mix old mortars that actually work.
Yeah. Thanks, Joel, for calling. I appreciate your call. I want to give Christina in Glenwood City a chance to join us. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. Thank you. Now, I have always wondered about this. Tubing for in-floor heat is enclosed in concrete. So what do you do if an area of the floor isn't heating, and how do you locate the issue?
Well, you can locate the area that isn't heating by using thermal imaging. And most home inspectors and a lot of heating contractors actually have thermal imaging cameras, so you can find the area where there's a problem. The other thing that you will find out is you'll be able to see every single loop in that floor. It's almost like having X-ray vision. Mm-hmm. And by seeing where the loops are that are working, you can pretty much figure out which loops are not working. And if they're actually leaking, sometimes what you can do is simply isolate those loops, because usually you have a manifold and you'll have multiple pipes coming out of that into the concrete floor. So you figure out which one is going to the area where perhaps it's leaking. And by the way, you can often find the leak as well, because you'll find this big blob of warm water under the floor with the thermal imaging. So if you have a concern with this, I call a couple HVAC guys first, see if they have thermal imaging cameras. If they don't, then check with the Wisconsin Association of Home Inspectors, American Society of Home Inspectors, and find a home inspector that has good thermal imaging cameras. Heat the floor up by running the boiler, and then they will actually be able to take pictures of all of this for you, and that will give you a lot of good scientific information.
And you can fix it.
Yeah. Well, maybe.
Maybe.
It depends upon how old it is, Larry. The old buildings, like First Unitarian Church here in town, actually had steel pipe that Frank Lloyd Wright designed in the floor. And when that broke, and when the Jacobs 1 house broke and Jacobs 2 house broke, they had to be replaced. Copper pipe was put in some places. The problem with copper pipe is that it can corrode, especially if it's in contact with a steel rebar or steel mesh, very hard to fix. The new material is usually a polypropylene or polyethylene, and that should last 100 years. So it depends upon the age of it. Sometimes what we find, if we've got the old steel pipe, we can actually get a new pipe thread, a new polypropylene-type pipe through the old pipe.
Oh.
Doesn't heat great, but it's pretty good. And there's even a way of doing it where we can thread it through, and then we can put a transfer, like an ethyl alcohol water mix, sealed. So we've tried to fill the pipe, but of course the pipe leaks. So there's a whole bunch of different ways of doing it. And a good HVAC guy that's done a lot of work with hydronics, I'm not sure exactly where Glenwood City is, but can usually figure that out. But the first thing to do is let's find out what's wrong, and thermal imaging is the way to go because it gives us X-ray vision.
There we go. Thank you very much, Christina, for calling. Appreciate it. I often wondered about that, how it could be fixed. Darren in Racine, it's your turn. Hi, Darren.
Hi, Larry and John. How are you?
Good. Appreciate the call.
I've got a 107-year-old double-width brick wall farmhouse that has no insulation in the walls. It originally had horsehair plaster over wood lath, but back in the 60s, some of the rooms had the plaster taken off, and about 3/4-inch thick tongue and groove wood was placed on the walls. So we're remodeling now, and I was originally thinking that I was going to take all the wood and maybe the plaster too off the walls and spray foam with like 4 inches of spray foam. And the more I've read about that, the more I'm realizing that that isn't a wise thing to do, because I'm going to change the dew point in the wall, and all my floor beams, my wood floor beams that are embedded in the walls, can rot because they're outside of the dew point now. So now I'm wondering what I should do. I'm wondering, should I just put like 1-inch or 2-inch thick XPS sheet foam and caulk or spray foam the seams, or what do I do when I want to replace this wood on the walls?
Very difficult question. If you can somehow access the American Society of Heating, Refrigeration, and Air Conditioning Engineers Association magazine, which might be in a library and it might be online. There's an article, I believe, in the April or May issue by Joe Stillbrick from Cambridge Building Science about retrofitting insulation in brick buildings. You have what's called a mass wall. That is, it's not a veneer. It's actually mass. So it's two width. Sometimes they're three and four width. The problem with them is that the brick currently is drying because you have the heat in the winter going out through the wall and your thermal drive becomes moisture drive. If you completely change that, you may find the brick simply begin to spall apart. And you're also very wise to think about the tails that are embedded into the masonry. So you've got a really complex system there. I think you're probably going to have to really talk to a design professional that knows something about historic work, but maybe you can get a hold of the ASHRAE journal and at least look at what Joe has suggested. I should have printed and brought that along today. I'll have that the next time we do a masonry program, but I hadn't finished reading it. It's so complicated. But you are right. We need to try to keep those walls warm. And you've got about an R8 exterior wall at this point. Now, can you foam part of the wall? Can you foam the second floor and half of the first floor? And so that you have different levels of insulation on the wall, so you have different levels of drying on the wall. That is probably what I would start taking a look at if I were actually there consulting with you. But it sounds like you're really pretty knowledgeable, so let's do a little bit more research, and if nothing else, you may have to talk to a good design professional to make sure that you are able to preserve this two-width mass wall.
All right. There we go. Thank you, Darren, for calling. Appreciate it. Dave and Delavan, your turn. Hi, Dave.
Hi. I appreciate you taking my call. The house we live in was built in the 50s. We've been told that the masonry work here was really excellent. The guy specialized in masonry. We're looking to replace our driveway and probably the front walk. And we had a couple of contractors come out and look at it. And what we've been told, they looked at the quality of the cement. I don't know if cement or concrete is the correct term here. And yes, it needs to be replaced because there's enough breakage and upheaval and stuff. But one of these contractors told us, wow, that was really nice cement. You'll never get anything that good again. And we're wondering, is the quality of today's cement or concrete that much poorer than it was back in the 50s? Or was that just a particular contractor who doesn't have a good supply chain? Or what should we be asking for? What should we be looking for to get good quality?
There is a National Concrete Association that discusses concrete. There are many, many types of concrete, and a lot of it depends upon how much cement, how much Portland cement is in it, the size and the type of aggregate, and what is really important is how it is poured. The condition of the subbase, the placement of the control joints are really critical. So it could be, they often talked about mixes and bags, as how many bags went into each mix, 5-bag mix, 6-bag mix, et cetera, et cetera. But we've always had lots of different types of concrete. And it could be that this guy just ordered something that had more cement in it, so it was a bit more harder, it was a bit less impermeable, and it lasted longer. But you can order something even better than you had then. Just make sure you work with a good, reputable contractor. And make sure that do a little bit of reading on the specifications. Make sure that control joints are placed, that you're not pouring against other solid structures, that sealing and caulking is done correctly, that it isn't overfinished, that curing compound is used on it, and educate yourself, and then I'm sure you can get a driveway that will last the 50 or 60 years just like your original one did.
There we go. Thank you so much for calling. And let's go to Ed in Dodgeville next. Hi, Ed.
Hi, how are you guys doing? I was just calling about that woman that had a problem with radiant heat in her flooring. If she has a leak in an area, she could take and find that leak by taking a dowel rod, putting it to your ear, and putting it on the floor, and it's just like a stethoscope. You'll be able to hear where that water is seeping out in through the concrete if it is a leak and not a blockage. And anytime you have running water in a pipe, you could take, this is an old way to do it, I'm old school, take a couple of coat hangers, cut the bottoms off, and then cut like 4 inches off of one end, bend it at a right angle, stick them out in front of you, and use it just like a dowsing rod, and you'll be able to find running water in that concrete or under your floor in any pipe in your house or in concrete. You'll be able to find running water, and wherever water isn't running, you won't find it. It won't. They won't cross. That's how I used to do it before all this high-tech stuff.
There you go. I'm not sure we're all as skillful as you, though,
yeah,
Ed.
I spent $5,000 on a camera because I could never get the coat hanger to work right.
There you go. Thanks, Ed. Appreciate it. All right, different way to look at it. Let's take some more calls here. Marie and Madison, your turn. Hi, Marie.
Hi, I'm calling. I have a house in Barneveld, so Iowa County. It was built. It's a limestone house built in 1878. It's beautiful, lovely. It is not at all insulated. And I'm just curious, the walls are about 18 inches thick. We have super deep window wells. You can kind of see how thick the walls are, but I don't think there's much for insulation between the rock and the actual old, you know, the plaster walls.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering, is there anything to do about that? I mean, it's cold in the winter and it's hot in the summer.
Sure. The first thing we really want to look at is we want to look at everything except your walls, because we really don't want to do anything to the walls. What we want to look at is, let's start with your attic. If we believe that hot air balloons exist, we know that heat rises. And we have what's called stack effect. And you have a house that probably leaks like mad. The warm air goes up to the second floor and then up into the attic and then out through the attic. So the thing I would do is I would start, unfortunately summer is coming and we really like to do this in the winter, but you want to go to Focus on Energy and you want to find an independent energy specialist who can come and assess your house. What they'll do is they'll do a blower door test. They'll depressurize your house to 50 pascals if they can. They may not even be able to get it that low because your house leaks so badly. So you'll find out how much air change you have. If you take all houses in the United States and average them out, and your, of course, is older and leakier, the average amount of heat loss due to air movement is 40%. Your house could have 60% of the heat loss due to air movement. So let's look at that first. What we generally find is that if we can air seal and insulate the attic, weather strip the windows, and on old houses, it's amazing how much air can leak around these windows, though they are set in stone. You can make it so that house is really quite comfortable. Basically, you've got about an R9, R10 wall there. And if you have the plaster furred out with an airspace, that adds another R1 to it. So you may find that there really is nothing worth doing to the walls once you fix the air leakage out of the attic and make sure your windows and doors are tight.
Makes very good sense. Thanks for, and again, get a blower door test from the, I just blanked on the name.
Focus on Energy. And in the winter, what's nice about doing it in the winter, Larry, is if it's 70 inside and it's zero outside, the thermal imaging cameras really tell you a great deal.
Thanks, Marie. Appreciate it. Paul in Winchester, your turn. Hi, Paul.
Thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it.
Sure.
My question to John is, I've just purchased a cabin that was actually part of a lodge, split it up into condos, but it's a single detached cabin, about 900 square feet, built in 1940. I did have an inspector come and do an inspection on the whole property, and the comment that he made on one of the inspection sheets had to do with some sloping that's occurring on the back of the home. His comments were also a lot about the fact that this is probably just a footing. There's a tiny, tiny crawl space. And I guess I'm wondering, especially after hearing and listening to the show, that it's hard to get PEs to do single family stuff as opposed to commercial. What do I look for that may be an indication of it being the failure of the footing? And also, the inspector commented about the crawl space needing some cross ventilation because he noticed that he noticed that the pipes were sweating, galvanized pipe underneath the house, that just actually a portion froze. I think it was copper that froze, and they put PEX in place of it, about 20 feet, I was told. So sorry, it might be a couple few questions mixed in there, but anything you can help me with on, I guess what I want to keep away is obviously moisture underneath the house because of all the floor being wood.
Right. We really do not want to get fungal growth in there and have things start rotting. Paul, how short is the headroom in this crawl space? Is it terrible, or can you actually get in there?
Well, somebody got in there. It's a great question because it is pretty small. I wouldn't want to mess with it because I have a bad back, but somebody got in there to fix this leak or this frozen pipe, put in the PEX, so I think it's doable.
Mm-hmm.
There's probably, I don't know, 18 inches of space.
Oh, okay. Well, 18 is very doable. Well, you may want to start with your home inspector and say, look, we need to evaluate this a little bit further. Would you mind putting on your safety suit and crawling around in there with your, you know, with your digital camera and shoot me every square foot of these walls and shoot me the ceiling, shoot me whatever you can. Now, here's the things that we want to do. Number one is we eventually want to seal that floor because we're getting water vapor and radon out of it, and neither of them are the radon's not good for you and the water vapor is not good for the wood. Number two, we want to see whether we've got structural integrity in the frost wall or not. And from looking at the exterior and looking at his photos, we should be able to get that. Next, we want to figure out how much air is coming in. We're probably going to find that there's sill boxes that are completely leaky. We want to get an idea of how damp this basement is, because if it's terribly damp, I'm not sure. We want to air seal, but we don't necessarily want to completely fill the sill boxes with foam, which is what we would do if it wasn't damp. But we need to come up with an energy plan, with a vapor retarder plan, and he's also correct about ventilation. We should have at least 1 square foot of ventilation into the basement or into something or other so that this thing is vented. Now, this may have been vented to the exterior, and there may not have been indoor plumbing when it was built. And that's the challenge we find with some of these. But why don't you start with your inspector? It sounds like he picked up a lot of things for you, and if he really is loath to go in there, he may know another inspector who's willing to work with you, and let's get a little bit further documentation so we know what we're dealing with.
There we go. Thank you so much for calling, Paul. Appreciate your call. And, John, your site is up now, but it's not full of all that information yet. So
I've got to sort it all and make sure. I have to double-check. And then there's this little things called copyright.
Yeah.
I've got it. Yeah, I really want to put Joe Stilbrick's articles up there, but I'm probably going to have to get permission. So I apologize to people that it isn't all up, but it will get better. Every time I'm on the program, Larry, I'll give you an update. We will get more and more information up there for our listeners.
And for the meantime, what's the site?
It's freibergerconsulting.com.
John, always a pleasure. You'll be back on August 9th, and we'll do this all over again. Thank you so much for being with us today. Appreciate it very much.
Always great being here, Larry.
Tomorrow on Garden Talk, Lisa Johnson and Brian Huddleston will be back to talk about plant disease and to take your gardening questions as well. So I hope you'll join us for that tomorrow at 11. And then the first hour replays on Saturday mornings at 7. And, of course, you can listen online at any time. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store.